Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey Fleck here along with Shad Marquitz. We are your hosts for this weekend show. Another fairly volatile week for stocks, markets broadly, as well as the metals, but maybe a little less volatile than the week before. The metals started off on the wrong foot to kick off this week, but stabilized a little bit towards the end of the week. All eyes, again, being on the Fed meeting next week and just how many basis points the Fed will hike rates. We're going to cover a lot of the market moves as well as some predictions looking ahead to Fed policy, not just to next meeting, but throughout the rest of this year, throughout this weekend show. We're kicking off this weekend show with Adrian Day, president of Adrian Day Asset Management, also manages the Euro Pacific Gold Fund. Adrian, before recording, we were chatting about the markets broadly, and I simply asked you, what's catching your eye? What are you paying most attention to? And you pointed to some of the macro factors. There's a number of different macro factors that we can touch on, but start us off, Adrian, with what you think is the most important macro factor, big picture, to focus on for investors.
Yeah, okay. Well, thank you. And thank you for having me, Corey. Hello, Shad. And I think the biggest macro factor is the Federal Reserve, what the Federal Reserve is doing relative to other central banks around the world and relative to the realities in the United States. That's a big topic, and there's a lot of dimensions to it. But to me, that is the biggest thing. I mean, the Fed is talking about raising rates and reducing the balance sheet and acting as though inflation, they're going to defeat inflation, which they don't think is that strong anyway. You know, the Federal Reserve members publish a thing called the dot plot, where they all make their predictions for where the inflation and where inflation and GDP and so on are going to be next year and the year after and so on. And inflation, they're looking for less than 3% inflation next year. That could be, but it certainly is that's a fairly aggressive assumption that inflation is going to get to under 3% next year and back down to 2%, which not coincidentally happens to be their target longer run. I don't see that happening, frankly, certainly not over the next 12 months. Just because inflation is already fairly, as we've discussed, it's fairly well ingrained in the U.S. at the moment and in other countries around the world. It's not just the U.S. by any means. And the Fed, their actions, or at least I should say what they're promising, is by no means, everybody's talking about the hawkish Fed, but what the Fed is promising is by no means hawkish given the environment. And that's important. If you look at what the Fed is talking about raising interest rates, a year from now, at the end of the next year, end of the next 12 months, real interest rates would still be deeply negative, more deeply negative than in the middle of the 1970s at the onset of a great inflation, if the Fed does its most aggressive plan for raising interest rates. And that's the key. You know, everybody thinks the Fed's going to back away, quickly and surrender and turn course. But you look at some of these previous examples when the Fed did that, and inflation was, the published inflation numbers were far lower than they are now. So we've got inflation at, 8.5%. You need interest rates to go much higher than 3.5%, which is what the Fed's bold action would call for. Same with the balance sheet. You know, reducing the balance sheet by $95 billion a month over the next 12 months would still leave us with a balance sheet of almost $8 trillion, which is more than twice what it was 2 years ago. So what I'm saying is that given where we are today in terms of the starting point for interest rates, where inflation is today, the Fed's actions are simply not fit for purpose. And they just sound hawkish in comparison with 2000 and 2007 and 2015 and so on. But the conditions are so much worse today.
Well, Adrian, I think you bring up some good points there, because the Fed has never been this far behind the curve. And so even though they're talking tough and they're talking what some people consider hawkish, to your point, and we joked about this a couple months ago, even if they did 100 basis point hikes a couple times in a row, we'd still have negative real rates and things would still be deeply negative. And so they're starting from so far behind the curve that even if they do what they plan on doing, it's not going to really do much to tame inflation. I guess my question is, if they are maybe hoping that some of these supply chain issues get worked out, that the war in Ukraine resolves itself, but basically they're hoping that the year-over-year comparables on inflation start trending lower, and so the rate of change in inflation starts heading down, and then they can say, oh, we can take a victory lap. But wouldn't prices still be really high for the consumer, really high for business, and couldn't that still put the brakes on the economy?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, first of all, for the Biden administration here in the U.S. and others to sort of point the finger at Putin and point the finger at China's COVID lockdowns, of course those things are not helping. But before Russia invaded Ukraine, inflation was already a problem. And, you know, I have no doubt that in 6 months' time, when, as we discussed before the show started, you know, the year-on-year comparables, the base effect will kick in with a higher base instead of a lower base. And obviously, it's much more difficult to get an 8% inflation, an 8% increase in prices when you're starting at a much higher level. But prices are not going backwards. They're not going back, I don't think. They're not going back to where they were before the war started. So I think to look at these other factors, these are, gosh, I was going to say icing on the cake. That's kind of not a very good metaphor to use when we're talking about negative effects like wars and shutdowns. But these things are simply incremental to the core reasons why prices are going up. And the core reasons that prices are going up, of course, is because money's being created excessively for 10 years, but particularly for the last 2 years. In the lockdown, we had $1 trillion worth of loans to small business. We had, what, $800 billion worth of checks handed out to people. Well, et cetera, et cetera. A lot of people refinanced because took advantage to refinance because of the Fed's policies pushing rates down. And so when they refinanced, a lot of people refinanced precisely to take money out. And so all of this free money and easy money, you know, is money that consumers spend by and large. And we're seeing that now. You know, I mean, on the last week's earnings calls from companies, all sorts of companies across the board, they're all talking about, you know, the consumer is spending. Well, of course the consumer's spending because they were given so much free money. So but that can only delay, you know, I've been asked, could the government sort of have another round of stimulus to sort of stave off a recession or a decline in the economy? Well, of course they could, but the more you do and the longer it goes on, the bigger the fundamental problems are building up. And you can't have a strong economy based on printing money and giving it away. And that should be obvious to everybody.
That is fair, Adrian, but can you have a strong market? Because quite frankly, we heard for the last decade that the economy was diverging from the markets because the markets kept doing pretty well as the economy was stuck in slow growth. And also to your point, yes, I guess historically the Fed is, well, interest rates are really low, but remember, we're probably going to get a 50 basis point hike coming, and it's been 22 years since we last got one of those. But to this point, it all seems so gloom and doom, right? Everybody's pointing to a recession. Everybody's pointing to the fact that the Fed just can't even hike rates for maybe one or two more meetings What if they can, though? What if everybody, all these gloom and doom, have gotten a little ahead of their skis, and quite frankly, we could be in for a year of slow and gradual hikes out of the Fed?
I'm not one that thinks that the Fed's going to reverse very quickly. I think the Fed is going to stay their course, and I don't think their course is hawkish, but they're going to stay with their course somewhat longer than a lot of people are thinking. And there's two main reasons for that. One is they're starting from a much worse position with interest rates so much lower than in 2000, you know, the last time they tried to hike. They're starting with rates much lower to begin with, and they're actually fighting inflation, which they weren't doing in 2013 or 15 or even back to 2007. They weren't really fighting inflation. And now inflation is a real thing, but they have to raise rates to fight inflation. So I think for that reason, as well as their credibility, the fact that they have repeated so many times what they're going to do, I think the Fed will stay the course somewhat longer than a lot of people are thinking. But that only increases the risk. I hate to say this, but this only increases the risk of recession, in my view. I mean, you know, when rates move up, balance sheets are, particularly corporate balance sheets, are quite strong right now. But if companies have borrowed a lot of money, when you had easy money, right, it encourages borrowing. And you had a lot of companies borrow money. And that money is not just sitting there in a bank account. Obviously, they did things with it. One of the things they did with it was buy back stock. A lot of companies borrowed money just to buy back stock. But they did other things with it as well. But the money's gone. That's the point. And so when the debt matures, companies will have to renew the debt. And that will be at higher interest rates. So that's just going to be a really negative drag on the economy, as well as consumers, of course. But it's going to be a drag on the economy. So I think we're seeing signs, and consumers, although they're spending, as I say, you know, short-term increases in money, whether it's a stimulus check or whether it's money they took out of a house from refinancing or whatever, you don't have very, very solid savings rates. You don't have very dramatic wage increases at the moment, particularly if you offset it by the decline in, you know, the employment rate. So you don't have, across the board, you don't have a huge increase in wages. So if you start seeing prices, if you continue to see prices move up, you may see the same dollar volume of spending, but most of that is simply because of prices moving up. And eventually people will have to decide, you know what, maybe we can't afford, you know, the driving holiday, or we can't afford the, you know, trip to the Bahamas. Instead, we'll take a driving holiday, or we already have the Disney and the Netflix and the Apple and the Roku or whatever it's called, you know, and the YouTube, and we've got all these, and HBO. My gosh, do we really need 8 streaming service subscriptions? And people would just start cutting back on things. And that, of course, is all incremental, and all pushes the economy, or all leads towards the economy slowing. But to your point, if I may, and I'm sorry I'm talking a lot, but to your point about doom and gloom and what about the stock market, yes, I mean, if the stock market can continue doing well with the Fed up until last month was still increasing its balance sheet. It was still providing liquidity. So the stock market can continue to do well in that kind of environment. Where the stock market will not do well, frankly, if history is a guide, is in stagflation. And in a stagflationary period, again, if history is a guide, gold tends to do very well, but stocks tend to lag. And bonds, of course, are the worst of all in a stagflationary period. So stocks can do very well with inflation, so long as you continue to have growth with that inflation. And in fact, in an inflationary period accompanied by growth, stocks are one of the best places to put your money. So the big question is, are we going to get continued economic growth, or are we going to see a slowdown in growth and, you know, perhaps a recession by the end of this year, or next year? And, you know, today, was it today or yesterday? All these days blend together after a while, don't they? The GDP number in the U.S., yes, everyone's talking about what the White House called technical factors. Well, there's no question that there were certain factors that made the GDP number negative, more negative than it should have been. But if you take out some of those factors, you still have a very, very weak first quarter, which shows to me that inflation, particularly on things like energy and gas, is just beginning to have an effect.
Well, Adrian, I think that it doesn't necessarily need to be doom and gloom. It actually is just math. Like when we look at it, if the consumer is starting to get tapped out, they've been spending, but they've also, if we look at some of the reports coming out, they're tapping their savings. They're starting to live on credit cards. And a lot of the spending, like you said, has been because of higher prices that some of these companies have done well. If higher prices persist because of inflation, the consumer will not be able to keep spending like they have been. And to your point, they may not take that vacation. They may not do that extra purchase. They may cancel some of their services. And then we're going to start seeing earnings reports from companies that are less than stellar. And your point about the GDP growth and stagflation is right on. We are seeing slowing growth paired with inflation, paired with high energy prices. And there's a point where some companies, if they get hit in the wallet and people can't buy anymore, the companies may start reducing some of their employees or cutting back hours. And then we'll have all of the ingredients for stagflation, which could lead to recession. So it doesn't need to necessarily be doom and gloom as much as it is forecasting and mathematics. So the one wild card has been the high dollar. And so people feel good that the dollar's high, but that's only in relation to other equally crashing fiat currencies. People's purchasing power is being eroded by that inflation. And I don't see that changing anytime soon. So couldn't things be setting up for a stagflationary event just due to the mathematics on it?
Yeah, no, I think everything you said is correct. I mean, I do think a couple of points, if I may, though. I tend to think in terms of labor layoffs, we're quite a ways from that. You know, what we've just been through in the last couple of years and the difficulty companies have had, a lot of companies have had hiring people, particularly, well, not only at the lower end, the lower wage level, but really across the board. I think companies are going to be slow to lay people off, personally. But eventually you reach a point where if your revenue goes down, you reach a point where you have to. But we're not there yet by any means. And you weren't suggesting we were. But on the point about the dollar, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's interesting, but we think, and you said it, that the Fed is so far behind the curve this time. But they're certainly behind a lot of smaller countries, you know, central banks, Estonia and, you know, Chile and other countries that have, Brazil, that have raised their rates. But in terms of the major central banks of the world, other than Canada, you look at the Britain, if Britain is still major, you look at Britain, you look at the ECB, of course, you look at Japan, you look at China, and they're all going in the opposite direction to the Fed. You know, ECB is saying, oh, yes, inflation, what a horrible number we just had from Germany. But that's it. That's the peak. You know, inflation is coming down now. So we can afford to be very slow in raising rates. You've got China that's actually stimulating the economy. On the one hand, they're locking down major cities. And on the other hand, they're starting to stimulate not the consumer, but they're stimulating infrastructure. And then, of course, you've got Japan that's doing whatever Japan has done for the last 40 years that clearly hasn't worked. But, you know, well, if it's not working, let's just try twice as much. And so the point I'm making, a serious point I'm making, is that every other major central bank in the world is to some degree or another moving in the opposite direction of the Fed, which means that the dollar's just going to, you know, money's going to continue to come to the dollar. Dollar's going to continue to be strong. And that's going to, that's one of the reasons, you know, one of the reasons that gold has been a little bit weak in the last, couple of, you know, the last month or two, after the spike we had when Russia invaded Ukraine. But, you know, dollar strength is, and that's obviously dollar strength leads to a greater trade deficit, and so on. So all these factors, all these ramifications come from the Federal Reserve policy, which even though it's not in any way hawkish, is less dovish than the rest of the world, without any doubt.
It is, and it's still a comparative game, right? We all circle back around to that aspect, that whether you consider it dovish or hawkish, what the Fed is doing, you compare it to other central banks, and what's about to come, it seems like, is going to be a fairly aggressive rate hike for what we're seeing around the world. So we'll see how the markets react, and we'll see when we do go into this recession or stagflation. Some of the recent data is pointing more towards that. We'll see if the Fed reacts early or late, or if we even get there, because, again, who knows if inflation's even going to stay as high as it has just in the last few readings. Well, maintained as high as it has really over the last year now. Adrian, thank you for your time. As always, good chatting with you. We'll chat again with you next month, and who knows what narrative we'll be talking about then, but it will, again, have some slant towards what central banks are doing. We'll see if there's still discrepancy around the world. Adrian, thank you again for your time. We'll chat again next month. Have a great rest of your weekend.
And you, thank you, and thank you for having me.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. I hope everybody enjoyed that first extended segment with Adrian Day, talking more about the macro outlook, especially when it comes to the Fed. In the next two segments, we are joined by Richard Postma, a.k.a. Doc. We like bringing Doc on more at the end of the month to recap some of the monthly moves, and Doc gives us an update on where he sees the markets going. We are going to touch on gold, but we're also going to touch on a few of the other precious metals, as well as commodities and U.S. markets. So let's get right into it, Doc, starting with gold. Gold down about 3.5% this month. However, gold did close above 1900 on the futures and the spot market. So a monthly close above 1900, some people find that encouraging. And quite frankly, the drop that we saw this month doesn't look devastating by any means on the chart. 1900 is still quite a good price level for gold. What's your outlook for gold now that we did just have a down month?
Well, the positive for gold is that we have left some gaps to the upside on some of these charts, which is... it tells you that we're going to be back up there someday, and the question is when. One of the negatives is we've taken out the 50-day moving average to the downside, and we've had closes below that now, so that's a negative. When you look at the weekly chart, the weekly chart on gold also looks like it's ready to turn over. I think next week could be a little bit of a negative for gold, and then we'll see what happens after that. But the charts I love are always the monthly charts, because those are the ones that as we've talked about before, get rid of the noise. And it shows what is most likely going to be the trend. We are in a trading range now, according to the monthly chart. And if we had closed above last month, this month, I think May could have been a horrendous month, because that would have been three higher closes in a row. And but we're closing lower. The question is then what happens in May? And we could keep challenging the upper Bollinger Band, but now the Bollinger Bands are starting to tighten, which is very interesting, and they could tighten further. And on the MACD, what was encouraging for the last 2 months is that the 12-month has actually superimposed on the 26-month moving average. And that's always a positive from the standpoint of, are we getting into a situation where we're bottoming? And so May is going to really hold a picture for us as far as that's concerned, whether that 12-month moves back off that 26-month moving average or not. And the strength indicators are still pretty good for gold, since they haven't sold off steeply. In fact, they've moved back up, which is also a positive. And that's moved down slowly over time, and we've talked about that. And that is really the strength indicators show the underpinning strength to the gold market. But having said that, there's one thing I'm really concerned about, is when you look at long-term charts, like the monthly charts, and I've looked at them for a long time, is you often, when you see a pattern like this on the monthly charts where the Bollinger Bands have turned sideways along with the 20-month moving average, in fact, that's even moved down a little bit. One thing that bothers me is that I said this months ago that often you see at least pricing of an asset class, when you see a picture like this, often has to challenge the lower Bollinger Band at least once. And it hasn't done that. And also, it hasn't challenged the 50-month moving averages, which have a little ways to go. So this bothers me a little bit, the fact that pricing hasn't impinged the lower Bollinger Band, which if gold continues to move down here over the next few months, it's going to probably impinge it right around the low 1700s. And that's the most worrisome thing, I think, about these charts.
Well, Doc, I'm sure that some listeners may not like to hear that gold could potentially head back to the low 1700s, but I understand the rationale behind what you're saying, that you think it needs to go back and test on the monthly that lower Bollinger Band. My question would be, why does it have to in a bull market? I know that we've been correcting for, you know, since August of 2020, but one could also argue we were just at 2050 back in March. So it's not like it fell out of bed and went down into the 1600s or 1500s. It actually got close to an all-time high, and then it actually hit 2000 again a week or two ago. So it's still bouncing up around that top level. Is there any way that it could avoid having to go down and test that lower Bollinger Band in the low 1700s?
It would have to break that upper Bollinger Band, and we would need 2 or 3 months of where we stayed above that. And we just can't seem to close above it. We've moved above it in pricing, and I'm surprised actually it did. And some would say it's due to Ukraine, because I've said in the past, I don't think we're going to challenge those upper levels any earlier than and resume this bull market any earlier than 2023. And it looked like it was going to, but it just couldn't sustain it, and it closed below that upper Bollinger Band. We would have to see some months that would close above that to really get excited about the fact that we're starting the next leg to the bull market. And that's what I would look for.
All right, Doc, let's move on to the gold stocks then. I'm looking at GDX here, and GDX down about 7.75% this month. The gold stocks, at least the majors, seem like they were doing pretty well. Underlying juniors, mid-tiers, development companies, those have continued to struggle, and I think pretty disappointingly, some of those juniors are back to levels pre-pandemic, which seems kind of unbelievable when you consider where the gold price has been, but these juniors continue to take it on the chin. What are you watching in terms of that gold stock sector broadly?
Well, once again, we have some nice gaps. that we're going to have to fill to the upside someday. Who knows when that's going to be. But what I would really like to see here is to see in May one more just ugly sell-off in these juniors. And then I think we'd be through it. But then the problem is, if we do that, it's not like we're going to just take off or a V-shaped recovery like we saw in March of 2020. We're most likely going to have to consolidate and build a base on these things for a while. I think that's what we're going to see in this sector in the future. But once again, it was discouraging to see the GDXJ sell off. And if you look at the last peak it was trying to hit, the last peak was back in June, in about June of 2021, when it was at about 54.76. We got up to 51.92. So we had another lower high. And so that tells you that there's still weakness in this sector and that there still probably will be going forward for a while.
Well, Doc, a lot of people are thinking that we need to see the metals prices break out to get any true traction and get some generalist investors coming in, which would fuel the miners higher. And then it takes a while for that to filter down from the largest producers and royalty companies down into those mid-tiers and juniors. You sometimes look at some different bellwether stocks, though. We've talked about Newmont in the past. We talked about Hecla. Just before this call, you mentioned you were watching Coeur. Are there any bellwether stocks that you're looking for that you think would signal a sea change in the whole sector?
Well, I would like to see Coeur get down to about two, maybe the upper twos, because if it does, I think the worst is over then at that point. And that's why I like watching Coeur right now, because and it's moving down toward that. Get a little recovery, I think we did today, but I think we're the next 4 weeks or so, we may move down to that 2 to 3 level that I'm talking about. But that's one of the ones I'm really watching. And Hecla is another good one right now. But the problem with Hecla right here is it's moving down again. And if you look at the weekly chart on Hecla, it looks like we're headed down below 5 again. But the chart that bothers me on Hecla is the monthly chart. When you look at the MACD, we're still in positive territory, but we're working our way down. And if we continue to do that with Hecla, we could be in this move down yet for 6 months based on the monthly chart. So that's not very encouraging. But I look at these other charts to give me a semblance of what gold and silver are going to do, because Hecla is a solid company. And but it still has not even worked its way down to a zero point on the MACD, which it looks like it's going to do. And so that tells me that we're going to be in this for a while yet as far as precious metals.
Doc, what about silver too? Because silver, it was outperforming gold for a while there. Even the silver stocks started to do pretty well, but silver never had that type of breakout, or at least close to breakout, that gold did when gold moved over 2,000 again. Just recently, silver very much stuck in the middle of the range and most recently topped out at about $27.50 and is now right around, let's say, $23 to end this month. Silver just can't seem to get out of its way and has been trading in this range ever since mid-2020. What's your outlook for silver?
Well, I think there's real good odds that 22 on silver again, or 22 to 2250. I said that on the site the other day. And sure enough, it looks like we're heading down to it. And the thing with silver is it tells you that even though there's underpinning strength to gold, that the precious metal sector is really struggling, because if it really was ready to take off, silver should react, I think, better than it is. As it relates to gold, but it's acting poorer, frankly. And silver really worries me, but I'll tell you what, there's going to be some really good buys in silver stocks with this move down. And every time silver moves down, those stocks, a lot of them get even weaker. And there's some really good companies in the sectors. And I've been watching those because I want to take initial positions at them at nice low prices. And I think we're going to get that opportunity.
Well, Doc, typically silver will lag the moves in gold. And when gold starts taking off, it comes like a dark horse from behind and then shoots past gold and outperforms it. And we did start seeing that just a little bit, but it was short-lived. And as Corey pointed out, it cratered back down again. Even at 22, it'd still be in that range it's been stuck in for almost over a year now, between $22 and $28. It just can't seem to get out of that range. I would be worried if it broke below that 21.41 that we saw, that intraday low. That was hit a couple of times over the last year. Do you see any potential of it breaking below there? Or do you think that it's just going to hit that 22 and then kind of hover there and wait for gold to take off to finally get its acting gear?
Well, yeah, and X, that's what I worry about, too, because what I don't like is what I said before about gold possibly getting down to the lower 1700s. And I say that possibly because, once again, it hasn't even challenged that lower Bollinger Band. And if that's the case, and if silver is still performing like it is relative to gold, we might not like to see that happen, because silver then could get down to as low as $20. And the MACD on the monthly charts on silver are showing that it is going lower. So is the strength indicators that next month we could see a lower silver price again. But if we move down into the 1700s in gold, that's not going to be very promising for silver, frankly.
One thing we have to consider here, Doc, is down as we've just talked about for gold, gold stocks, and silver, we look to the U.S. markets and the S&P, that's down a little over 7% just this month. Broadly, we are seeing weakness in general markets, and the NASDAQ, that's down 11.5% this month. So, hey, look, precious metals are doing bad, but so are the conventional markets. Let's talk about the U.S. equity markets. What is your outlook for these markets that have been weak all year so far?
Look for more weakness, Corey.
Weakness across the board, hey, Doc?
Yeah, you're not going to want to be in this conventional market, I don't think, the next 2 months. I said back in December that I felt this was going to be a bad year for the conventional markets, and it's playing out. And I mentioned how, watch January, because January often is your precursor. Sure enough, January was not very nice to the markets. And now we're sitting, when you look at the S&P, we're sitting right now at the 400 exponential moving average. We moved off of that back in March. And now we're right back to it. But I'll give you a dollar to donuts that next month we're going to take that out. And once we take it out, we're going to have a real problem in those markets. And we're going to start the next leg down. And I think that's almost a foregone conclusion. I would be very surprised if we don't see some real ugliness in May. And that's also going to not be a positive for the precious metals. They seem to be inverse a lot, but I don't think when that happens, when we break lower, whether, you know, the precious metals will be inversely related this time around, because when you start to see that kind of damage, people don't care what asset class they own. They just want to get out of it. So it's not going to be a positive thing.
Yeah, Doc, when we see those liquidity events, it becomes a sell everything kind of market, and no sector is spared. You said dollar to donuts. That makes me think of the raging U.S. dollar we've seen lately and the high price of donuts and food, the high price of inflation. A lot of this is on the back of the Fed policy and the interest rate hikes. But we're in a bizarre environment where we're seeing a high dollar, but we're also seeing high inflation. It's like deflationary and inflationary at the same time. Very strange market. What do you make of the U.S. dollar? Is it getting close to topping out here in this parabolic move, or does it have further to go? And how might that affect the commodity sector?
Yeah, and what's bad about the dollar is that the dollar, if we close up here, well, it looks like where we are, is we've taken out previous highs, gone back over the last 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, about 8 years or 7 years. And previous highs down around the early 2017 was 103.82. And the high at the beginning of 2020 was 103.96, and but we're going to close higher than their intra-month close. So that is not positive for those who wish to see a break in the dollar. But we're getting into overbought territory, but we may be up here for 2 or 3 months yet. And so I think the commodity area is starting to top out too. I think copper is showing some weakness. And if the Fed is really, if they really walk the talk, which I think they will this time for a while, of course, we don't know how long that's going to be. But I think that also is going to be an obtuse factor for commodities. And the dollar won't do that any favor.
Yeah, fair enough, Doc. And the dollar moving higher. We've also seen a bit of a bounce in bonds as well. Interest rates have essentially skyrocketed from, yes, very low levels. They're still at very low levels. But you look at the rate of change of where, let's say, the 10-year was. The 10-year just back in March opened at about 1.7%. We're up almost at 3% right now. That's a huge move just in 2 months. Also goes hand in hand with the Fed tightening. And now the Fed seems like most likely going through a 50 basis point hike just next week. What's your outlook for bonds and interest rates broadly?
I think the bond market is broken right now. And on the monthly, it's taken out some very important support areas. When you look at the 50-month moving average, simple moving average and the exponential moving average, it has closed significantly below that for the first time in years. And that tells you that we're starting a really reversal in this bond market that we haven't seen in years. And that should worry everybody. And I get the sense that once the Fed has to do what it does, they're going to have a hard time reversing all the damage that they're going to create. They've been jawboning so far, but now they're going to really show whether they mean what they've been saying. And I'm afraid they are. And they're going to stick with this until they cause a real crack in some market. But I'm afraid they're going to cause cracks in most of the markets. It's going to be housing market, bond market, stock market, commodity market. Commodities might not get hit as solidly because of the supply constraints and other things. But what they want to do is basically beat down demand because really this inflation is demand pull from supply chain issues. And they have to beat down the consumer demand to see a real reversal in the rate of inflation. And I think they're going to get it by July because of their policies, not only their policies, but that's when the real inflation started back in July of 2021. And so the comparisons year over year are going to get better, I think, by July just on their own. And then through the damage they're going to create, it might even make them look a little bit better.
Yeah, Doc, it's interesting because that base effect year over year, it may show that the rate of change in inflation is slowing down because they were so high last summer, but prices will still be high. And so the last question I have is, you know, we hear a lot about inflation, we hear about stagflation, we hear about possible recession. Is it possible with, I mean, we just had a negative GDP quarter, which is not good. And if we keep that trend going, you know, are we in a stagflationary environment? Could that lead to a stagflationary recession if they keep this hiking policy up and do their 175 basis points that they want to get done by July? Could that take the wheels off the cart a little bit in the markets? And do you think that'd be enough pain for them to eventually reverse course?
I do. I think we could see them start to become mealy-mouthed possibly by August because I think they're going to start to realize the damage they inflicted by then. But it might be interesting that, and I think your assessment is right about a stagflationary recession. We're going to see a recession. I don't think... Of course, we've probably been in one for years, but it's been manipulated by easy money. because we keep stealing from growth from the future through low interest rates. And so I think we're going to see somewhat of a stagflationary recession. But when they start to become mealy-mouthed, we might realize that inflation is still higher than they would like to see. It might not be below that 2% year-over-year range that they would like to see. It might be 2 to 3%, and they might start to back off then because they'll be possibly alarmed by that time by the impetus they've created as far as in these markets. So that's what I'm looking for. I think we're going to have to watch for how they speak by summer. I think that's what folks have to watch. And so that's what I'm going to be watching is how they talk the talk come July and August timeframe.
Duck, wrap us up. Just a quick update then on what you're doing within your portfolio. I know you've been nibbling at a few metal stocks, but it also sounds like you think those could be going lower and offering some cheaper prices. Are you shorting the U.S. markets? Give us just a broad overview of your strategy right now.
I'm short the U.S. markets, and I've done well. In fact, I added to my shorts today. And because I'm anticipating May, because I think it could be a crucial month. And if we go get below that, if we stay below or get below that 400 month moving average, exponential moving average on the monthly charts, that's going to be a very negative sign. So I am short the conventional markets. I'm nibbling on some of these explorers and companies that have just got crushed. Companies that I think will stay in business, and some of the mid tiers as well. I'm in no hurry here. I'm still very heavy in cash because I don't think there's going to be a V-shaped recovery of these stocks, especially these exploration stocks, anytime soon. So there's no hurry because there might be even a little bit more downside to some of them. So I just keep buying now. Every week I've started to purchase now, not in any volumes, but I'm going to continue to be doing that.
All right, Doc, always great chatting with you. We covered a lot in this two segments, but I think there is a lot to recap here. And remember, as much as we look individually at sectors, we need to understand that everything is down this month. And look, everything has actually been looking quite weak throughout the tail end of this month. There have been some actually decent sectors, but again, just the sell-off in the last couple of weeks, I think, caught some people a little off guard. Doc, thank you, as always, for your time, buddy. We'll chat, I'm sure, by the end of next month. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Corlin Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment.
All right, welcome back here to wrap up the weekend edition of the KE Report. We are chatting now with Brian Lenny, founder and editor of the Junior Stock Review website, also writes a premium newsletter where Brian shares a lot of his due diligence, a lot of what his models are telling him about precious metals stocks, mostly focused on a bit more advanced stage projects, not the grassroots discovery plays. A lot of projects that have an asset and have some sort of an economic study. And Brian, you dive into these economic studies. You run your own models. The problem being with developers right now is that they don't seem to be getting any love. I don't know if the market doesn't think that they can finance projects or if it's just too uneasy about the move into production, what have you. It seems like developers or more defined assets, multi-million ounce assets, are not getting any love. Maybe there are simply too many of them out there right now. Broadly though, Brian, as you've been running some of your models, what's your takeaway from potentially the undervaluedness that the developers carry in the sector right now?
Well, thanks for having me, Corey. You know, I think that definitely is a big portion of where the value is right now in the market. I think the big problem is it's not the sexiest part to be. You know, people want to see expiration where, you know, they've got that blue sky potential and, you know, the stock can move 10 times in a week. Or on the producing side where there's cash flow and there's quarterlies and there's, you know, you can trade those. Whereas the developers really are in that kind of, I don't know what you want to call it, but that middle zone where, you know, they've got some ounces, which is actual real value as opposed to the exploration companies, but they don't have that cash flow. All they're doing is burning. So I think invariably when you get into markets like this, it's seemingly the first group of companies that, you know, takes it on the chin. And, you know, for people that kind of focus on that, like such as myself, it brings a lot of opportunity. But what I think investors need to contemplate is really focus on those catalysts on how that company is going to get that value recognized. You know, there's numerous examples like in the premium portfolio right now. You know, I really, really like the top, you know, seven companies in the portfolio, and each of them have a very good value proposition, you know, meaning good risk to reward. But the market just isn't recognizing it right now. It doesn't care. So for me, I continue to look and try to find new projects that offer, you know, great value, but really concentrate on those reasons why the market is going to recognize that value and, of course, move that share price upwards. So for me, you know, it's been a slog over the last like March and April. March was actually quite a great month with the gold price being so strong. Met a ton of companies and some companies that have added to the watch list, but I haven't found necessarily anything that I want to take my cash and invest into the company because I just don't know if the market is necessarily in the mood to recognize developers for the stuff that they've or the value that they've added. But, you know, honestly, if you've got a longer time horizon, I think that's exactly where you want to be. And for me, I'm still, you know, 90% invested in the market. So in actual fact, you know, I'm still very much in the market. It's just that last 10% that I haven't deployed yet.
Well, Brian, I find this topic to be very interesting as someone that also invests in a lot of development companies, because I've noticed there are literally about two or three dozen companies that have defined pretty interesting resources, 1 million ounces, 2 million ounces, 3 million ounces, 4 million ounces, 8 to 10 million ounces. There's a lot of them out there, but there are a couple different categories. And this is what I'd like to ask you about. There are some that we kind of see each cycle. Yeah, they've got a lot of ounces in the ground, but they're bulk tonnage, low grade, not that interesting, and they never seem to get built. There are some that have come up recently, just in the last year or two, as new companies that also have big ounces, but they maybe were forgotten projects and they've got big resources. But again, not all resources in the ground are the same. There's different strip ratios to get them out. There's open pit, there's underground, there's combos where they're somewhat open pit and then they go to underground. What has your attention when you're trying to pick which development companies you think have those catalysts that are going to get either a major interested in buying it or that's going to allow investors to jump on the train and watch them move it from development into production?
I'll answer two different ways. Firstly, I'll say that I don't have a defined or set criteria exactly for the company. Like economics is definitely, or the quantitative side of things is definitely the first thing I look at. And then some qualitative factors, like especially the people that are running the company, the amount of money they have and such. And then, you know, broadly speaking, again, I think you can never count out size, meaning that, you know, they got a big property size, you know, let's say 10,000 hectares. The ounces, you definitely want to have over 100,000 ounces of production. And, you know, these sort of numbers. But that doesn't necessarily have to be the way it is. And that's what I'll answer a second way. I think that, you know, these juniors can have different stories, and these different stories can be made up of different components. And I'm going to talk mainly about the qualitative side here, such as like where they're located. Let's say there's a 1 million ounce deposit, oxide deposit in Nevada, and it's located, I don't know, near a mid-tier producer or even a senior producer. And let's say it's fairly high grade. Let's say it's 1.5 grams per ton, all near surface, all the other stuff, you know, works out. So the value's there in what you calculated in your discounted cash flow model, plus the company is selling at a discount to that value. And then you've got the other component of, you know, their proximity to this this mid-tier or senior, and you know, the truckability and the easy processing of the ore, I think you can put together a storyline that says, hey, you know what, this is a very attractive project to that mid-tier or senior producer. So in those cases, if the storyline fits, I would be a buyer. Conversely, you know, if you're looking at deposits, let's say it's up near James Bay or, you know, northern Quebec, and you've got that same million ounce deposit, it's not oxide, but you know, it's 100 meters deep, and it's, you know, fairly good grade, let's say it's, you know, 5-6 grams per ton, I think you're gonna have a really hard problem if you don't have some more scale there. A million ounces up in James Bay, northern Quebec, is going to be quite hard for you to develop. And I think there, you know, for that story to work, you're going to have to see size there. You're going to have to see probably 3 million ounces. The grade probably works, and then again, you want to see over 100,000 ounces in available production. So I think, you know, I don't think it's ever really, you know, these components, it's how all those components flow together and how that story builds. And that's, so when I'm looking at stuff, I don't necessarily discount anything at first, but I want to see how that whole story comes together. And that's mixed with the fact that the company has to be selling for less than it's worth. And that's how I, you know, get my degree of safety when I make that investment.
So, Brian, you've been around this market for a while. We all have. And quite frankly, I remember a little over a decade ago, when you had 1 million ounces, people took notice. Oh, okay, this group has 1 million ounces or 2 million ounces. To Shad's point earlier, it seems like we have a lot of these projects right now. And it's been something that's in my head recently is that, do we have too many defined resources that are of 1 million to 2 to 3 million ounces? That won't get taken over, so it makes it even harder to value these multi-million ounce deposits because there are more of them?
Yeah, well, you know, I guess it's a matter of perspective. It's like, what is your time horizon? So if you're saying in the next 3 to 5 years, then I would say, yeah, there's going to be a huge percentage of those deposits that don't get developed. And then the second to that is, but if you have a 20 or 30 year timeline, then, you know, those 1 million ounce deposits might mean a whole lot more in 20 years than they do today. But for most investors, and myself included, I'm looking at the next, let's say, 2 to 3 years is kind of where I'm looking. And so then you have to be really, really choosy in what you look at, and kind of what I was describing in the last answer. You have to make sure all those components of the story work. Again, the quantitative side, like the deposit has to have some good economics. So if it's 1 million ounces, you know, you need to, really, if it's 1 million ounces, you're probably looking or hoping that it's an oxide deposit near surface. So those, you know, upfront capital costs are lower. You're probably need to be near some infrastructure. Like this thing's probably can't be located the far reaches of Alaska or, you know, the Northwest Territories or the northern part of the Yukon. So, you know, what I'm saying is these components all have to work, and it definitely takes some thought into how the investor looks at it and puts that whole story together and really, you know, is able to justify themselves why this smaller deposit is going to get built or bought by a senior mining company. And that's, you know, honestly, that's why I would say, and I think most investors, if you talk to the like really experienced guys who've been around for 30, 40 years, they say you don't bother with small deposits or small mines, because small mines have the same problems as big mines. And they're absolutely right. And I think for most investors or the majority of investors out there, really, you should just be focusing on those top tier things that really stand out, where you don't necessarily have to do a ton of thought. You can look at the people running the company, you can look at the deposit and its economics and say, hey, you know what, this is a top tier or world class deposit. And realistically, given my knowledge of the sector, this is probably where I need to put my money and have the least risk of losing it. But again, it all depends on the investor, you know, what their risk profile is, what their knowledge level is, and, you know, how they actually view the market.
Well, Brian, just one more question that comes to mind on developers is, there is also, I'll split it into two different categories on this one. There's companies that have a defined resource. They're not really doing a lot of drilling. They're working on economic studies. They're moving it from a PFS to an FS. They're doing metallurgical work and they're trying to get it bought out, but they don't have a lot of value drivers that animate the market other than a couple key milestones. And their whole, we've talked to probably a half dozen of these, not just in gold, but in copper too. Their whole value proposition is, once we put out this economic study, then people will want to buy us. or we'll have to make a construction decision. Then the other side of this is companies that have a big deposit and they're continuing to grow at their expiration, and they're hoping that the drilling success animates the market and gets people excited. Between those two camps, are you more excited about the companies that are moving it forward with economic studies to like get that big milestone, or are you interested in companies that still have all that expiration upside?
It's hard to answer that question straight up because, again, I think it's, there's so much that it depends on, you know, all the other facets that kind of lead into it. What I'll say is this, you know, typically those companies, like it's probably the biggest difference, I think, between the ASX and the TSX and how the companies are run. A lot of the Australian companies that I've talked to over the years, you know, they are much more prone to go through the whole process and put a small mine into production and then start to grow it with cash flow. And a lot of the companies have been successful in doing that. On the flip side, the venture companies over here in North America have been much more prone to not putting small mines into production and maybe selling the story that's what they're going to do. But really, they just plod along and try to grow the resource slowly, or like you said, on the other side, focus completely on exploration. Again, it's hard for me to answer. But what I'll say is this, is that you need to have catalysts that catch the market's attention. And typically, in my experience, economics, PEAs, pre-fees, feasibility studies don't usually get, they're actually, I think they're mostly used as liquidity events for longtime shareholders. So invariably, I don't think that they necessarily bring the value that they're always thought that they might. Really where that value is, I think, mostly driven is in that exploration potential. And of course, a good base and whatever that is. So if it's a million ounces and these guys keep on exploring, I think that's probably what you're, especially in a market like today, that's probably where you have your best chance of catching market attention and really having people, you know, again, you'll get that blue sky when you've got a hope and a dream. I think that's probably where you have your best chance of moving share prices. On the other side, the people that are just solely focusing with, you know, small deposits on economics, you know, who knows? Not every story is going to be the same, but I think they're less likely to catch market attention. And in fact, you might see the releases of those economic studies as liquidity events, meaning that you might actually see a share price drop. But again, that's just how I view the market right now. And of course, each company is different.
Each company is different. Unfortunately, it seems like every company is getting sold down right now. So that makes it a little bit tougher. But either way, though, Brian, it is always great chatting with you. And I do appreciate you wrapping up this first hour of the weekend edition of the KE Report. Again, everybody, thank you for tuning in. And please keep in touch when you have any questions or you think that we should be featuring any companies on the show. Our email addresses are fleck@kereport.com and chat@kereport.com. We're going to be back with all of you Monday morning. Please, again, go back through our website, check out all those daily editorials from last week. I hope you all have a great rest of your weekend.
For our upcoming appearance schedule, visit kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back in just a moment.